Welcome to the podcast version of Sunday Miscellany, which differs from the radio version for rights reasons. We hope you enjoy the programme.
We had a Christmas wedding. This time, 27 years ago, we walked out of the tiny church in Duncannon County, Wexford, and into a wild December wind. It picked me up off my feet and turned my veil into a sail. My new husband had to hang on to me or I'd have been carried out to sea. In the safe harbour of the hotel, we greeted our guests in front of a huge Christmas tree. Spirits were high, sparked by the roaring log fires. When the bell rang for dinner, the crowd was hard to corral. The chef was worried the meat would be cremated. Eventually, we took our seats in the dining room, the wedding party seated at a round table in the centre of the room, like the hands of a clock around a giant candelabra. Everyone was smoking. By the end of the meal, my mother had her first baby grandchild in a sleeping suit in her lap. My father was on his feet, gregarious as he prepared to toast this union of two families. It put the seal on a friendship that had begun before the foundation of the state. My grandfather, Tom McMahon, and my husband's grandfather, Tony Woods, had fought together in the War of Independence. They both took the anti-treaty side in the subsequent Civil War. After the fall of the forecourts in June 1922, my father told our wedding guests, they had the pleasure of each other's company in Mountjoy. 15 months later, the war was effectively over, but Tom McMahon and Tony Woods were among many thousands of anti-treaty prisoners still languishing in jail. Tony was in Newbridge by then, Tom in Mountjoy. On Sunday, the 14th of October 1923, the prisoners' leaders called a hunger strike to protest their continued internment. The strike started on D Wing in Mountjoy when the men refused breakfast. It quickly spread to other jails, and by the end of October, as many as 8,000 were refusing food. These are facts, and easily verified. But alongside the facts, there is story, passed down to us by word of mouth. This we cannot check, only retell, as my father did at our wedding. And what do you think they talked about while they were on hunger strike, he asked our wedding guests. Food was the answer. They used to compete with each other to come up with the most delicious menus they could imagine. They might pretend they were in a restaurant, Jammies or the Russell. There weren't many restaurants in Dublin at the time, so there wasn't much to choose from. Someone would take the part of the waiter, the others the diners. Painstakingly, they'd peruse the fantasy menus they'd devised. Imagine the sweet torture of it as they agonized over their choice on an empty belly, then refused the food that was offered to them by their jailers again. The hunger strike was called off by the prisoners' leaders on the 23rd of November, 1923. One of the men in Mountjoy asked how many days they'd done. 41, he was told. Be cripes, he said. We bet Christ be a day. Once news reached the men's relatives that the strike was over, hampers began arriving at the prisons. But the extraordinary self-control required to refuse food during the strike was now extended beyond it. The prisoners were warned not to overindulge for fear of causing themselves harm. For days, they followed a diet of lemon juice, eggnog, and brandy. Bovril and cornflour were gradually introduced, then biscuits. For all the fantasies they'd entertained of a sumptuous five-course meal, my grandfather credited this strict regime with the good health he enjoyed in the years that followed. Most of the IRA prisoners were released shortly after the hunger strike ended. The vast majority were home with their families by Christmas, and what a Christmas it must have been for them. Tom McMahon and Tony Woods remained friends for the rest of their lives. Tom and my grandmother Lucy were regular guests at the open house Tony and his wife May hosted for old comrades and friends at their home in Sandyford on Friday evenings. Sandwich spreads were served, along with good quality coffee and an almond ring or a cherry log from Bewley's. The one topic of conversation that was taboo was the Civil War. By the time I met Tony's grandson, my husband-to-be, our grandfathers were both long gone from the world. The war and the part they'd played in it was the last thing on our minds. Love affairs take place in the present tense, proceeding in time to take a tilt at the future. It's only later that you see the past as a part of you too. Gathered with our families on that wild winter night on Hook Head to celebrate our marriage, my father raised a toast to Tom and Tony. Two young men, one-time cellmates, who had endured a hunger strike that took the lives of two of their fellow prisoners. But for Tony and Tom's survival, none of us would have existed. How they would have enjoyed this meal, my father said. The menu was worthy of their wartime fantasies. For starter, a choice of smoked salmon with dill blinis or a chicken tureen. Then the chef's signature duck velouté, followed by either fillet of beef or turbot with saffron cream. The dessert options were a chocolate marquise or Christmas pudding with brandy butter. The wedding feast was a celebration of love, a gathering of community in support of a young couple embarking on their lives together. It was also an occasion to honour family and history, and maybe even life itself.
Whilst the ox and ass, whilst the ox and ass are granted the gift of speech, having knelt in adoration of a child, it would represent a breach of decorum were we to listen in. For all those exiled from their native lands, all those gagged whilst the ox and ass are granted the gift of speech. All those who've dragged their belongings over a border. It's still a reach to take in why two lambs might cry out each to each across the crevasse of a manger. Whilst the ox and ass are granted the gift of speech, they almost immediately sense danger. And like us, are almost immediately struck dumb. Beseech is the word. The lamb will beseech and beseech us never to keep mum. Whilst the ox and ass are granted the gift of speech. So, ladies and gentlemen, that first poem is written in a very particular form. It's called the quatern. And when I discovered it a couple of years ago, it occurred to me that had I known about it 20, 30, 40, or 50 years ago, I would probably have written nothing but quaterns for the rest of my life. Because as you will have divined there, when you've got line one in stanza one, it reappears as line two in stanza two, line three in stanza three, and line four in stanza four. And as many of you will have determined, I'm sure, one of the reasons why people who go into the poetry business go into it is because they're Well, they're disinclined to work very hard. So, yeah, you know, this is what's known as a labor-saving device. In any case, the second Christmas poem uses the quatern as a base, but also throws in a little refrain, a nonsensical refrain. So many of the refrains historically were indeed nonsensical, and this certainly falls into that category. George, who's mentioned here, is King George III, just in case you're wondering, and a dotterel, of course, I know there's a big contingent of bird watchers here, is a bird. Anyway, so this is my second Christmas poem. There is no room here for a king. I should mention, perhaps, that I live in the United States of America. There is no room here for a king since George was sent off. Tail firmly between his legs, with a hey and a ho and a hey ding-a-ding. A red-kneed dotterel masquerading as a lapwing to draw us away from its olive-brown eggs, whilst proclaiming to the skylark in its lone furrow, there is no room here for a king. With a hey and a ho and a hey tingling, a young couple setting out on a burrow to be enrolled in the promised land will often cling to the idea they must bear mudslings and sand stings as they make their way to an inn, only to be told with a hey and a ho and a hey zing-a-zing, there is no room here. For a king to be presented with gold, frankincense, and myrrh may now be not uncommon. But though we accommodate a giver of rings with a hey and a ho and a hey ka-ching, ka-ching, a tech bro from Beijing, even a Boston Brahmin, there is absolutely no room here for a king.
This is called Palo Santo, and it's dedicated to those who are facing into Christmas while brokenhearted for any reason. I light my stick of Palo Santo every morning and watch the flame elongate towards the ceiling and blow it out to let the smoke rise in thick ropes around my face. According to the AI Google search result, Palo Santo cleans energetically, clears negativity, and deflects against evil spirits. I'll try anything. Sage in the living room, Palo Santo in the kitchen, crystals obviously throughout. I think about the dry trees in South America where this holy wood comes from. Bolivia, Brazil, Ecuador, Peru. I think about the wood from those trees now sitting in a shot glass in my suburban window, and I think about the transfer of wisdom. I think about what we know that rests underneath what we know. I let the musty smell of it aerate the room, and the cat sneezes and leaves to claw up some more of my carpet. I inhale the dusky smoke that lies heavy in the air. This is how I begin my day. We are alive. We are here. What does that mean? The Grinch became the Grinch because as a child he was bullied during a school Christmas party for his green skin, pear-shaped face, massive whiskers, ugly smile. So the Grinch violently expressed his distress to protest the hypocrisy of a season that wills us to keep our pain silent and our faces bright. We're turning on the lights as the land is calling for darkness, and we're forcing ourselves out as nature turns inwards. And we're asked to smile for photos as our hearts bleed inside us. And we're wearing light-up jumpers and forcing secrets down our throats. And we're grinning and bearing our grief so tightly to our bones. How cruel that silence can be loud, that emptiness can still glow, that alleged peace on earth should ache like this. I think the Grinch is a monk, a mirror, and a gift. In both hands, he gently holds our sacred wounds, and he dwells with them comfortably and expresses them easily with courage in a season where the surround sound of profound grief is met with M&S ads for sausage rolls and expectations of cheer and good times and peace and love and Christmas pints and Christmas pints and Christmas pints and Christmas pints, and Christmas pints that gets louder and longer and brighter every year. The Grinch is unafraid of the dark. I asked God how much pain a human heart can hold, and the answer was infinite. The human heart can hold infinite pain. I light the holy wood. I breathe in the smoke. I remember who I am. Why can't we be broken open when breaking open is an expression of love, and the result of that expression is peace? Peace and love. Love and light. Etc. I'm not going to try to make myself feel Christmas cheer. I will honor my responsibility to the dark. Nights lit by the torch of my phone, the soft soil of the forest under my heavy form, and I will close my eyes and listen to the treetops above dip and sway. I want the darkness to take me into her abyss and let the winter shroud over me, and unresistingly, open-heartedly, let myself drop slowly down until the images and sounds and pulls and decoys of the surface world are dulled and then silent. And I'll close my eyes and welcome its wisdom and prayers. I want her to take me down to the truth of who I am at the bottom of this holy well of pain, wrap myself around the roots of the land I am living in. I am a human and I feel. I am a human and I do not pretend. What can we love but what these heartbreaks give us? A chance to be more than what we were before. So a Christmas manifesto for the broken-hearted Grinches among us. We'll find pockets of joy where we can, if we can. We'll be tender towards our broken hearts. We'll tell the truth about our existence. We will not stop others from telling theirs. We will not deny ourselves the honor of feeling. We will trust the life we are living and the bodies we've been given. We will not defend against this dark. We will surrender softly out to it. We will light the Palo Santo every morning. We will remember to breathe. And when at last this deep retreat of the earth has released us and we claw our way through the soil and bark and forest detritus into the upper world again with its lights and triggers and relentlessness, Inside us will be the trembling treetops above us. Inside us will be the soft, warm, underground silence. Inside us, the sky will be bluer than ever.
This Christmas day, when the dinner is eaten and the guests are snoozing contentedly in front of the television, I will go outside to the garden as I do every year, and I will smoke a big, fat Cuban cigar, and afterwards I will be sick at the foot of our beautiful holly tree. When I return to the house, green of complexion and sweating profusely, my wife, Mary, will ask me why I insist on smoking cigars when they clearly don't agree with me, and I will tell her the same thing I always tell her, tradition. It's a tradition that stretches all the way back to 2006, when I bought a box of 50 handmade Cohibo Robustos on a visit to a cigar factory in Havana, and I vowed that I would smoke one every Christmas until the box was empty. At the current rate, that will happen on Christmas Day in 2056, when I will be 86 years of age, provided I live that long, which I suppose is in the balance. While I despise cigars and absolutely dread smoking them, my yearly appointment with a Cohiba resembling a dinosaur's knuckle offers me an hour of quiet reflection in a period of Christmas chaos. And it's in that hour that my mind starts to turn to the next milestone in the calendar, New Year's Eve, which also happens to be our wedding anniversary. In 2010, we were planning to spend it in Las Vegas, and I had read online about a party in Caesar's Palace where the host was none other than Rihanna. Perhaps it was the effect of the cigar smoke causing a decrease in oxygen flow to my brain, but I decided that there was no better way to mark our first year of marriage than to spend it at a party hosted by the pop and R&B singing sensation. The tickets were €1,000 per pair, but I was feeling flahoolock at the time. The publishers of Nigella Lawson's Christmas cookery book had expressed an interest in my world-famous festive sprouts recipe, which involved frying them in butter with bacon and pistachios, then scraping the sprouts into the bin and eating the butter, bacon and pistachios straight from the pan with a spoon. We arrived in Las Vegas on New Year's Eve, ready to party. We made our way to the nightclub. The place was empty, which was understandable given that it was 6 p.m. We went to the bar and we ordered drinks. As we sipped them, 6 p.m. turned to 7 p.m., then 7 p.m. to 8 p.m., people started to arrive, but there was no sign of our host, which I thought, even for a three-time Grammy Award winner, was what we Irish call a bit much. I asked the barman, any idea what time herself will be in? He said it could be any time. Then he pointed to the far side of the dance floor and said, when she gets here, that's where she'll be. I looked on in disbelief. You don't mean behind that glass screen, I said. Yes, that's the VIP area, he told me. You didn't think you'd be hanging out with her, did you? Actually, for €1,000, I flipping well did think I'd be hanging out with her. The website stated clearly that she would be hosting the party. I had hosted many gatherings over the years, including quite a number of successful Christmases. Call me a traditionalist, but never did any of my guests have to look at me through an inch of bulletproof glass. We bought fresh drinks, and at my insistence, determined to get my money's worth from the experience, we stood with our faces pressed to the glass, waiting for Rihanna to arrive. 8 p.m. turned to 9 p.m., which eventually turned to 10 p.m., as it often does. The nightclub was packed, but there was still no sign of Rihanna. By now, I was bursting for a pee, but I didn't want to give up our position, which offered us quite literally a window into the world of the foxy Barbadian singer, businesswoman, and philanthropist. So we stayed where we were, nodding our heads to such hits as Umbrella and Don't Stop the Music. Me crossing my legs and staring through the glass with the intensity of a bear at a foxhole. Rihanna eventually showed up at 15 minutes before midnight. And to say she made a fuss of her guests would be an overstatement bordering on an outright lie. She sipped a glass of champagne and barely cast an eye at those of us thumping the glass to try to get her attention. Then, seconds before midnight, with my bladder now pleading with me to put it out of its misery, Rihanna stuck her head over the top of the partition and shouted, Las Vegas in the mother flippin' house, which I've chosen to sanitize for you. Then she said, 10, 9, 8. The countdown completed. She wished us a happy new year. Then she, well, flipped off. Possibly home, or more likely, to a better party. The following morning, on New Year's Day, bleary-eyed and jaded, we drove from Las Vegas to Los Angeles, stopping to have breakfast at a restaurant in the desert called the Peggy Sue Diner, where all the waiters and waitresses were dressed as Buddy Holly. I don't think I've been storing my Christmas cigars properly, was all I could offer Mary by way of an apology. I think I saw mold spores on them. Please, she said, put them in the bin. But I remind myself that it was on Christmas Day in 2007, while smoking the second cigar from the box, that I thought in the coming year I might ask her to marry me. One of my rare, better Christmas decisions.
Too early in the game, This is the time of the year when, in our obsession to be together, we simply must tear ourselves apart, apportioning and rationing ourselves so that everyone gets at least a little bitteen of everyone. I'm talking about that great seasonal migration of men, women, and children stampeding cross-country to get their feet on holy ground. You know, Mam's place. The tune you are singing as you hit the motorway will depend on whether you are steering in happy anticipation of your journey, or if your journey is fueled by high-octane anxiety. Whether you're stuck on the M50, traversing the Dun Kettle, or going giddy on the Monongahela, when you take a look at the driver next to you, you'll know he feels the same. All of our 1,000 memories ricocheting around the confines of the car. Sure, we could cruise home fueled just by the adrenaline. Ireland is a traveling circus at Christmas time, and for a few years, my own children had a very unusual ringside seat, an annual tradition amongst many medical families, now long lost to health and safety. Wearing their new festive clothes, they would head off in their car with their father, accompanying him on the Christmas morning ward round in whatever hospital he was then working at. Nursing colleagues would fuss over them with selection boxes before they headed down into the wards. Stuck in hospital on Christmas Day, sick patients were always delighted to meet them, asking about what Santa had got them that morning, and most insisted on pressing a pound coin into their palms. Looking back, I think of how crazy a thing it was, but also how wonderful it was. All across Ireland, Christmas visits are a veritable family safari of sorts, where we coo over the lovable creatures, dread the fearful ones, laugh at the clowns, and shed tears for the ones that didn't make it. So this circus is coming to us this year, as I get for the first time to be a full-blown Irish Christmas mammy for real, grandchild and all. Our beautiful baby granddaughter, with Indian and Kerry blood coursing through her veins, has completely stolen our hearts, reduced us to Egypt levels of singing and dancing potty. So you can understand why I am nearly up the Christmas tree with excitement, hoping to make it as special as possible. And when she is older, a few Christmases from now, I hope to share my own childhood memories of this special time of the year with her. I tell her how, when I was growing up in India, my first ever sleepover at a friend's house coincided with Christmas Eve. I had been invited to go with my best friend Juliet's family, who were Catholics from Goa, for midnight mass at Mumbai's beautiful Holy Name Cathedral. As we strolled the mile down to the church on a luxuriously cool Christmas Eve, the atmosphere was distinctively carnival-like. Closer to the cathedral, the crowd swelled, lingering at the stalls that had sprung up on the pavements. It was hard to ignore the garish lights and shells resplendent with all sorts of temptations. Our progress was slow as friends were met and then greeted on the way. During Mass, I watched my friend closely, dutifully following every genuflection and gesture, overcome with the solemnity of the occasion and stirred by the singing. Midnight Mass is still the highlight of Christmas for the 31 million Indians of Christian faith. The spirit of the festival, though, has always permeated across religious boundaries. In our Hindu home, we eagerly awaited the pre-Christmas arrival of trays of sweets, slices of Christmas cake, boxes of dry fruits and nuts, and invitations to Christmas parties. To be honest, and in retrospect, it was the differences that we liked. It was difficult to resist a brandy-laced fruitcake when the norm was the traditional Hindu milk sweets. But what the heck, if that small culinary point was what initiated regard for another person's religion, then long live alcoholic fruitcakes. Yes, I'll be telling her that and more. In these next few days, every time I'm behind the wheel heading home, getting things ready for baby Mia's first Christmas, I'll be praying that the world she grows up in will be a happier place than it is now. That with her Indo-Irish family around her, her four doting grandparents, uncles and aunts, the loving spirit of Christmas will prevail, and driving home will always be fueled with joy.
And that was the first of two Christmas Miscellany programmes recorded at the National Concert Hall with the RTE Concert Orchestra and special guests. The scripts were The Menu by Kathleen McMahon, two poems by Paul Muldoon, Whilst the Ox and Ass, and There Is No Room Here for a King, Palo Santo by Mia Doring, What Are You Doing New Year's Eve was by Paul Howard, and Driving Home for Christmas was by Corey Madhaven. The music, all performed by the RTE Concert Orchestra with leader Brona Cahill and conducted by Gavin Maloney, was God Rest Ye Merry Gentlemen, arranged by David Wilcox, sung by the Palestrina Choir, directed by Blanid Murphy. Réjouissance from Handel's Music for the Royal Fireworks. In the Bleak Midwinter by Gustav Holst was arranged by David Downes with Geraldine O'Doherty on solo harp. What Are You Doing New Year's Eve by Frank Lesser, arranged by Kathleen Flynn, was sung by Lisa Lamb. And lastly, Joy to the World, arranged by Mark Wilberg, and that was also performed by the Palestrina Choir, directed by Blanid Murphy, with the RTE Concert Orchestra, conducted by Gavin Maloney. And there are a couple of books related to today's programme that you might be interested in. The first is Scanty Plot of Ground, a book of sonnets edited by Paul Muldoon. That's published by Faber and Faber. And Corey Madhaven's latest novel, The Inheritance, is published by Hope Road. Part two of Christmas Miscellany will be on Christmas morning. And the guests then will include Joseph O'Connor, John Toll, Ethna Shortall, Quentin Fottrell and Naomi Beryl, as well as Lisa Lamb, the Palestrina Choir and the RTE Concert Orchestra. That's 9 a.m. Christmas morning here on RTE Radio 1. On sound this morning, Garrett Duffy and Damien Gavigan. Sunday Miscellany's broadcast coordinator is Elaine Conlon and the producer is Sarah Binchy.
You've been listening to the Sunday Miscellany podcast. For more from us, you can follow the programme on Facebook, Twitter, Spotify or Apple Podcasts. Just search for RTE Sunday Miscellany.